Christopher Lydon, and this is The Whole Wide World. The mission of this radio series is to pull apart the riddles of globalism and to thread our own path through the contradictions that come with a shrinking planet. 6 billion of us Earthlings can feel it now that we're inextricably bound in many dimensions: environment, economics, culture, the genomics of our one global species. At the same time, though, lopsided measures of wealth and tools, toys and power, and the politics of terror seem quite capable of undoing everything. This hour, we'll take a short journey from big picture economics to architecture to literary fiction. For much of the first half hour, we're talking with a development economist who's chafing at the limits of his science and of U.S. politics.
It's a little preposterous of a population that's 5% of the world's population that absolutely depends for its prosperity on global peace to think that we will bully the world.
But there's a back of the book here, too, of writers and artists talking about globalism and plain folk with their own take on it.
We people in small countries can now engage global cultures without necessarily becoming destroyed by it.
The Romans understood globalism. The British understood globalism. The Russians understood it. I don't think Americans quite get that.
I think there's an odd idea amongst a kind of white majority that minorities consider themselves from an attitude of otherness. They don't.
Can you really be a global citizen? I doubt it. Am I Chinese? Or am I Singaporean? Or am I a citizen of the world?
We'll also retrace some of my steps in the past year doing talk radio in the Caribbean, in West Africa, and in Southeast Asia, trying to show that a local conversation can strike a global spark live on the internet.
We have been independent for 40 years, and yet we still go cap in hand begging.
America have this view of itself that is just really amusing, that they have a basketball match, the East Coast versus the West Coast, and it's a world tournament.
Everything in Singapore is about fabrication. It's an air-conditioned nation.
We're tired of hearing from everybody else but ourselves.
I started to write my own alphabetical list of the symptoms of our global condition. A is for AIDS, the pandemic. B is for Bono, or Bob Marley for that matter. C is for climate change. D is for Davos, the bankers' forum in the Alps. E is for Ebola and the killer viruses. F is for the financial markets that never sleep, trading yen, euros, and dollars. G is for the genome, the universal code of our human architecture. H is for the hungry 2 billion living on less than $2 a day. I is for the internet, the free global instant message service. I is also for imperialism, the no-no name for military, financial, and cultural domination. And on through the alphabet down to Y for the global musician Yo-Yo Ma, and Z for Zadie Smith, novelist of the globally cross-pollinated North London scene that's Jamaican, Bengali, Jewish, Chinese, Pakistani, and vestigially English.
This has been the century of strangers. Brown, yellow, and white. This has been the century of the great immigrant experiment.
Listen to this thematic fragment of what I think is a prophetic global novel, Zadie Smith's White Teeth. She leaves you no doubt that coming out of the century of strangers, we've arrived at a new place. She's writing about London and a neighborhood where the whole British Empire seems to have come home to roost. But try this out at a city playground near you. She is noticing kids with a mix of front and back names, like Quang O'Rourke and Isaac Leung, names that tell you something's changed.
It's only this late in the day that you can walk into a playground and find Isaac Leung by the fish pond, Danny Rahman in the football cage, Quang O'Rourke bouncing a basketball, and Irie Jones humming a tune. Children with first and last names on a direct collision course. Names that secrete within them mass exodus, cramped boats and planes, cold arrivals, medical checkups. It is only this late in the day, and possibly only in Willesden, that you can find best friends Sita and Sharon, constantly mistaken for each other because Sita is white, her mother liked the name, and Sharon is Pakistani, her mother thought it best, less trouble. Yet despite all the mixing up, despite the fact that we have finally slipped into each other's lives with reasonable comfort, like a man returning to his lover's bed after a midnight walk, despite all this, it is still hard to admit that there is no one more English than the Indian, no one more Indian than the English. There are still young white men who are angry about that, who will roll out at closing time into the poorly lit streets with a kitchen knife wrapped in a tight fist. But it makes an immigrant laugh to hear the fears of the nationalist, scared of infection, penetration, miscegenation, when this is small fry, peanuts, compared to what the immigrant fears, dissolution, disappearance.
We'll come back to Zadie Smith's vision of a hybridizing world. Vegetables before dessert, though. Dismal science before design issues. Let's suppose that globalization is first and fundamentally an economic doctrine, premised on growth through free trade. It's a vision of open markets around the whole planet, a trading world without borders. Jeffrey Sachs is an eminence that the world and I trust. He's a development economist. His head is a work in progress. A boy wonder on the Harvard faculty, Sachs became the famous shock therapist of the late 1980s, applying market principles to the sick economies of the communist bloc. The cold shower worked for Poland, then it gave Russia something like pneumonia. But by then, Jeff Sachs was famous for other remedies. He coaches the Irish rocker Bono of U2 in the campaign for debt forgiveness instead of endless austerity as the way to treat bankrupt countries. Jeff Sachs has moved to the Earth Institute at Columbia in New York to be closer to Kofi Annan, the UN, and the fight on AIDS and other world epidemics. I began by asking him if the masters of the universe that he knows well and moves among know what they're doing.
No, I think that's painfully clear. People live in their own worlds, not necessarily in the worlds and the realities inhabited by billions of other people on the planet. No, they don't have the expertise to understand the deeper problems. It's fairly frightening. Certainly, we're living in a dangerous time right now. We seem to be at the edge of war, of all sorts of conflict. We are facing monumental challenges, whether it's a disease pandemic in AIDS that is the biggest killer epidemic in modern history, or whether it's a change in climate that we feel in our droughts this summer and the floods in Europe and the floods in Asia and the failed monsoons in India and the drought in southern Africa. And no, the expertise is not where it needs to be. It's not with the leadership. Even the experts don't talk to each other. They don't understand how their problems are connected. We're somehow not naturally geared to understand the problems across the street, much less around the world. So while you talk about a converging planet, perhaps the most shocking thing is really how divergent our lives are right now. The billions of people who are struggling to survive and the billion or so very rich people who sometimes seem to be completely unaware of their presence until disaster hits.
That's the way it feels to me, and I'm sort of the more scared to hear you say it. But is it a matter of expertise, or is it a matter of heart, understanding, intention?
I think heart and intention is the starting point, because that would tell you, gee, I better really understand something about this issue. I better not just dismiss the poor and the dying around the world out of profound ignorance, as U.S. officials have done implicitly and sometimes shockingly explicitly when they've said, well, we can't treat people with AIDS. They can't tell time. We can't address their problems.
Take the pill or something.
They won't know that it's morning and night, and therefore we're just going to have to stand by them and let them die. And of course, that's a matter of heart and ethics at the start, but then it really does get into knowledge, what to do, how to do it, how do you mobilize goodwill to real results? How do you make connections from community to community? How do you handle some of these big challenges that are really global challenges, much more complicated than a lot of the things that we normally grapple with?
I want to just ask you to stand back and decode this global thing and the many globalisms. I mean, this is the economic doctrine about the free flow of capital, somewhat less free flow of goods and workers. Environmental globalism, this dread of climate change, habitat collapse. There's the whole refugee matter spilling here and there and having very scary effects in places like France and Australia. There's global disease. There's also global medicine and global pharmacies. But I also want to talk about the genome, which is, seems to me we forget this enormous sea change in the way all of us think. We know now, as we didn't know when I was in college, that it's one species with a universal grammar, a whole host of universal human qualities. It's one brain, probably, the world over. And all the old differences of race and complexion and hair kink and whatnot are very, very recent and cosmetic things. I said this to a wonderful man in Africa, and he said, you know, it's good to know that biological connection, but the disparity of social circumstances has never been greater. And he talked about, you know, we read about Chinese men putting themselves in the cargo bay as a way to get to England, or, but he was talking about not just boat people, people virtually crawling across the Sahara Desert to get menial jobs in Greece, say. But he also said a fascinating thing right out loud on the radio. He said, you know, my friends and I, we talk about if you put a slave ship in the harbor at Accra in Ghana and said, we're going to America, risky passage, maybe generations of agony, but we're going to America. He said it would be full overnight. And that's Ghana. That's, in many respects, a model country. How do we deal with this, you know, these many, many strands?
You made pretty clear and pretty vivid how much upheaval in our world there really is, and this is a story of our generation. It's a story of recent generations. The world's changed in such fundamental ways within the course of three or four lifetimes that we're just trying to race to get our minds around some of these realities. You know, it took thousands and thousands of years for very, very slow growth of the human population to fill the world. Then all of a sudden, about 200 years ago, the population explosion. We've got 6 billion people on the planet now. 2 centuries ago, it was 1/6 of that, about a billion people. The fact that our technologies have thrown us together so that people that are literally at the edge of death may be bombarded with television images of Beverly Hills and are somehow the most impoverished and the richest are thrown together in this common cultural space. We never had that before. And our ethics did not prepare us for this. Our ethics taught us a lot about living within our local communities, but it often poisoned our capacity to bridge across communities, much less across different regions. It seems to be our fate after September 11, almost to fall into Sam Huntington's trap of the clash of civilizations, as if somehow Christianity and Islam are going to be off to war with each other. We seem to be condemned through our simplicities and simple-mindedness, our inability to have a real discussion across cultures, our tribalism still in the early years of the 21st century, to pull back from war, which could be absolutely devastating.
Let's just talk about that. I mean, the Bush doctrine, we're number one forever. We'll intervene where we choose, with friends if possible, but on our own, if not, it's basically our way or no way.
That's a little preposterous. It's a little preposterous of a population that's 5% of the world's population, that absolutely depends for its prosperity on global peace, to think that that we will bully the world. When I go to China, as I do regularly, and you see these huge cities and the technological advances in the buildings literally going up before your eyes and literally around the clock, whether they're putting up new floors at 2 a.m. because they can't, it's just economic growth without limit. You understand that we're really not the center of the universe. We're not even the center of our planet. It's not for us to bully the whole world. It won't work in the end, but could do a lot of damage trying, no question about it.
I wanted to bring Jeffrey Sachs back to economics and the scorecard of development. For a lot of poor countries, the game is about getting loans and blessings from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. But the Nobel Prize economist Joseph Stiglitz, who served high in the Clinton administration and is now Jeff Sachs' colleague at Columbia, has just blown a very big whistle on the development game. It's sort of a shell game, he has written, an invitation to still deeper debt.
What does the world do with this kind of candor?
There's been a huge progress from world markets and international trade for a lot of people. Think about China. It's booming. And a boom in China, that means 1.3 billion people with significant, even unprecedented economic advance in the last generation, heavily due to globalization.
But not China, to the World Bank and not to...
Oh, certainly not to the specific advice of the IMF.
But not to foreign loans, is what I mean.
And in the case of China, it's been very clever policies to attract foreign investment, the true globalization. A lot of American and European and Hong Kong and other factories are built on China's coasts, now employing tens of millions of people, putting out all the goods we buy all the time. It's the biggest export boom in the history of the world. So that's globalization that's successful. But on the globalization scorecard, has globalization worked for Malawi? Has globalization worked for Tanzania? The answer is absolutely no. Is it because they're just bloody-minded dictatorships? No, those two countries happen to be multi-party democracies where the presidents are real leaders, they're sophisticated people. But the problem is that with the malaria, with the AIDS epidemic, with El Nino, with the droughts, with soil depletion, with impoverishment, globalization doesn't reach them. And the IMF and the World Bank advice in those countries have been absolutely dreadful. It was absolutely destructive of what those countries needed. What those countries needed was a healthcare system. What those countries needed was not the budget cuts that the IMF championed. What those countries needed was help. And the IMF didn't say, we bring help. The IMF said, we bring the message of budget cuts or else. So globalization is complicated. And sometimes the winners are winners because of good policy. Sometimes the winners are winners because they happen to be on the border of a rich region. Sometimes geography is devastating, as it is in drought-ridden Malawi right now. And frankly, that seems to be as much related to the warm waters of the Eastern Pacific and the current El Nino as it is to anything that President Maluzi is trying to do to keep his people alive. And that interconnection of climate, population change, disease, it's complicated. It's off the radar screen of our policymakers. They don't care anyway, particularly about these, quote, little places with dying people. Until then, by the way, Chris, you turn around and then the story is, oh, the Congo, this place we could care less about, may be a place where uranium is now going to be, is being smuggled or has been smuggled or could be smuggled to Iraq. And all of a sudden, these meaningless little places start looming in significance for the United States. The truth is, in an interconnected world, it all matters. And that's the, it matters not only for our heart, it matters for the most practical ways as well. We have a million people with AIDS. AIDS started in a jungle in West Africa, according to the genomic evidence. AIDS wasn't picked up as a disease that spread probably from a chimpanzee to a human maybe having eaten bush meat or hunting in the bush. It wasn't picked up in Africa. It probably fulminated in Africa for years, but since there's no healthcare system, since there's no disease surveillance, we just sat back and all of a sudden the whole world is fighting this pandemic. Are we interconnected with the jungles of West Africa? You're darn right we are, in the most direct and tragic and painful way. Are we interconnected with what you would have probably put on the map as the most remote place in the world that couldn't conceivably do us any harm? Of course, I'm thinking of Afghanistan. Of course, we found out we're interconnected with Afghanistan. Do we have a stake in the Congo? Well, if it's uranium that's getting to Saddam's regime, you're darn right we have a stake in the Congo. But we're not geared up to think about these things. We're geared up to believe that we run things, that it doesn't matter what happens in the rest of the world, that we really don't have to care. When I say we, I actually don't mean the American people. I mean the way that the political system and our leadership has missed the truth on this and is missing the truth right now.
Listening to Jeffrey Sachs, it strikes me now that part of what we're hearing is a brilliant and idealistic man catching up with the limits of his best thinking, the limits on a lot of good effort. Jeff Sachs made house calls as an economy doctor to Bolivia and to Vietnam in the mid-1980s with a bag full of monetary theory. I was amazed to hear, and I think he was amazed to say, that at that time it didn't occur to him that geography had something to do with the economic development paths of Bolivia, which is 13,000 feet up in the Andes, and for Vietnam in the thriving Pacific Basin.
And this obvious geographical point, it's so trivial that it sounds preposterous, not only was not in my own observation at the beginning, but it's not even in the professional observations today. Because if you ask what's wrong with country X to a typical economist, they'll give you a long list of economic variables. They won't mention whether there's malaria. They won't mention whether you're on an earthquake zone. They won't mention whether you're landlocked at 13,000 feet. Completely unrealistic. Because there's an incapacity, it seems, to move beyond the stovepipe of the narrow discipline to address other issues.
So global experience keeps a good economist humble, and it's kept Jeff Sachs moving from the classroom to the world, from debt issues to diseases, from a Detroit boyhood and an American perspective to putting his big hopes with the UN. Doing radio myself on the road this past year, I've sometimes felt like a very poor man's Jeff Sachs, catching up with the many conundrums of growth and prosperity. You see spectacular differences in the trajectories of development between, say, Ghana, poorer today than it was on liberation 45 years ago, and Singapore, which got its independence from Britain and Malaysia about the same time and now lives richer than most Americans do at home. You see very different shades of post-colonial feeling and politics. Ghana and Singapore have both come to love the Brits. The Queen of England is a celebrity and a friend, as she is in Jamaica. So unlike Zimbabwe and the raw anti-colonial anger that President Mugabe could still whip up in his re-election campaign, there are terrific contrasts in cultural vitality as well. And oddly enough, Ghana turns the tables on Singapore there. Ghanaians are hugely invested in their musical voice and its place in the world. What is Africa's comparative advantage in the cultural marketplace, I asked. The bold answer was, Africa supplies the content. In dance, design, music, Africans see themselves as the source. Rich Singapore, on the other hand, feels voiceless. As a young playwright said to me on the air in Singapore, even if we find this voice, we wouldn't want to recognize it unless someone from the U.S. or the West would give us a prize for it.
We don't really value what we have. Everything that we need could be easily imported. So why struggle with a local culture? Why struggle with a local voice? Why struggle with anything which is indigenous?
Which gets back to the conversation with Jeffrey Sachs.
The Ghanaians know their music, and they know their culture, they know their history, and they're deeply invested in it. The Singaporeans basically have bought Hollywood and Bollywood, and when they'll tell you, we don't know who we are anymore. They all want to talk. That's one thing in common.
Especially with you, Chris.
Well, they bear with me, but question is, I mean, none of the single answers apply, but are there still answers, Jeff, in figuring this puzzle?
There really are answers, and some are obvious. Some are not so obvious. Some require a lot more work. So if you see in Ghana that malaria remains as it does, absolutely rife in the cities, in the countryside, killing children still in very large numbers, you have to say, well, that has to be attended to. It's pretty much common sense that that each society, if it's going to have a chance, has to have healthy, surviving children that go to school and that therefore can participate economically in our global conversation, in our global economy. Singapore, as an island without the mosquito vectors that Ghana has, didn't have that problem. Singapore also, by being on the sea path between China and Europe and Japan and Europe, has about the best real estate in the world from the point of view of an international trading system. It was the center of the trading node. So when Lee Kuan Yew boasts about all that he's done, and he did a great job, if he were out in the South Pacific, it would not be Singapore. He was just where he was because he had the best location in the world from the point of international trade. Well, Ghana, you got to get the port working. It's another obvious point. So you look at these problems, then here comes the real rub. Ghana is in a trap of poverty. It actually just can't afford to fight malaria and keep the children in school and pay the doctors enough not to leave. And you can do it on a napkin, you can do it on a spreadsheet, you can do it on a full-blown budget. They can't afford to get out of poverty. That's the trap that they're in right now.
That's one important point that Jeff Sachs says he got right from the beginning. There are certain desperate cases that cannot save themselves.
I always did know from the practical experience, and I hope from the heart in the right place, that a place like Bolivia needed help. I knew from the first day of Poland, if we didn't cancel the debts, Poland could not get out of communism. It all adds up to continuing crisis for Ghana. And all of Singapore's success, and it's a success of globalization, doesn't prove the case that globalization works willy-nilly for Ghana or for its neighbors in West Africa or for many other places in the world where it isn't working.
So there is an uncomforting overview from a congenitally cheerful economist who says that his colleagues are not factoring in disease or population or climate, that the policy guys are in a bubble, that our better public instincts are not engaged yet. Coming up next, the globalization of arts and letters. You're listening to The Whole Wide World, produced in association with WGBH Radio Boston, from PRI, Public Radio International.